I feel like the story is so great. It's so it's such an unbelievable story that I can't do justice to it. And so I know there's things that I miss, and I know that I don't understand it all. I know that, there's a lot more that could be said. I simply, with my limited understanding, I'm trying to do my best. So hopefully you can gain something from it and be encouraged and be blessed. So I want to just, I always start with review. I always struggle with that, not sure what all to say, what all to review. We're doing a series here. We started in Genesis 1, and we're all the way up to chapter 11 today. Often when I ask questions, I don't get much of an answer, so I just decided, well, rather than ask questions, I might as well just say it all over again. So we're going to spend a few minutes here in review. So as I understand it, if you were a Jew growing up in Jesus' day, and you would be asked, why is our world in the shape that it is in? They would give you three answers to that. Today, we pretty much just point back to chapter 3 of Genesis, the fall, and that's our one and complete answer. They would give you three answers for that. It would be Genesis 3, Genesis 6, Genesis 11. So we have death introduced into our world in Genesis 3, where Adam and Eve did what was good and right in their own eyes. And then, of course, we have the stories of Cain murdering Abel, showcasing that death. We have the Lamech bragging to his two wives about the murders that he did. And then we have Genesis 6, where the sons of God come down to earth and mingle with humanity. And if you read Genesis 6, it simply mentions fornication. And we went on a little bit of a dive there into the book of Enoch, which Jude and Peter both quote from. And Enoch mentions that there was a lot of other knowledge passed down. It says that these sons of God taught these men how to make swords, knives, shields, breastplates. They made them known the metals of the earth, the art of working them. Bracelets and ornaments, jewelry, arts of seduction. It also mentions that they taught them about plants and roots and cutting of them. So I would kind of take this to say, this is probably where some of the knowledge of drugs came from, possibly. Witchcraft, extreme hate and violence. And we know that was the case before the flood of lots of death. And basically, the sons of God taught the men taught them altered states of humanity, how not to be a human, is basically one way of thinking about that. So you have the acceleration of depravity, just the knowledge of evil accelerated. And then Genesis 11, that's the one we will look at today, where humanity is divided and disinherited. So last time I preached was in Genesis 10, and I want to review two verses from Genesis 10. Verse 32 is the summary statement of the chapter 10, but I'll go ahead and read 31. This is the summary of the line of Shem. These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues. So notice we already have tongues. So this is, I noted there that chapter 10 actually comes after chapter, or takes place during chapter 11. So we're actually, chapter 11 is going to back into chapter 10 and tell us where these tongues come from. After their tongues, in their land, after their nations, plural, we have nations already. These are the families, here's the summary statement, verse 32. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations, in their nations, and by these were the nations divided after the flood. So That little, we're really going to pay a lot of attention to that, the nations being divided today. That's going to be kind of a key phrase here, is this is where the nations were divided. Okay, so I also mentioned this last time, and I think it's important again just to kind of see where we're at in the story. So Adam had three sons, Seth, Abel, and Cain. 10 generations later, Noah has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. 10 generations later, you have Abraham, and he is one of three sons. Okay, so one thing that all these have in common is they all have a new beginning. They all start with a new beginning. They all start with a command to be, or a blessing, and to go forth and fill the earth. So obviously Adam there and Eve were to be fruitful and multiply and fill the land, and those very same things were repeated to Noah and his sons. God blessed them and told them to go out and be fruitful and multiply. So we have a new beginning there, a new start. And then, of course, Abraham is going to be called out and be blessed, and God's going to start all over with Abraham and disinherit the nations. And this is approximately 2,000 years of history, one-third of human history as we know it, in just 11 short chapters. So you really stop and just ponder that. And why these stories? Why not more chapters? Why just these stories? Why this one after this one? I think it's all very intentional. Okay, so enough for a review. This is, the title is The New World Without New Humanity, Part 2. And let's just begin to read Genesis 11, verse 1. Genesis chapter 11, verse 1. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. Verse 2. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime or tar had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto the heavens. And let us make a name, lest we be scattered upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they all one language. And this they began to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down and confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from hence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord there did confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Okay, let's go back and start in verse 1. So we have this idea here that the people were all unified. They were all of one language, that's all of one tongue. One speech there gives more of the idea of being of one heart, one matter, or one purpose. In other words, they were unified in their goals and in their mission. So they were of one language and one mission, you could say. Verse 2. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east. Now, do you remember which way Adam and Eve and Cain were taken when they were pushed out of the garden? They went east. God pushed them to the east side of the garden, and then Cain went on further east. So they're coming back from the east. Now, of course, this is after the flood. I don't know if we're supposed to get the idea that they're trying to create their own Eden here. I don't know. But they're journeying from the east, little interesting detail. And they find a land, they find a plain, in the land of Shinar. And they dwelt there. Now, is this the first time that we've read the word Shinar, the land Shinar? It is not. This is the second time that we have this word Shinar, this land Shinar. The first time was in the last chapter. And it was when this, when Cush begat this name, this man Nimrod, whose name is means we will rebel, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth, or he was a mighty name in the earth. He was a Gibor. Okay, that's the same thing was said of the fruit of the sons of God coming down to the daughters of men. They were the Gibor, the mighty ones, the men of renown. Okay, so what about this man? Well, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it says, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel in the land of Shinar. So you're already getting negative tones here, I feel like. And we're already a little unsure about this Gibor guy. And this guy that's creating a big name for himself. And he has a kingdom, and it is Babel, or Babylon, in the land of Shinar. So now we know where we belong in the story. We're back here in Nimrod's kingdom. We're back here in Nimrod's territory. So that's where our story is taking place. And we kind of, right away, we're just like, ooh, this don't sound good. All right, so verse 3. We have a brand new technology. All right? So we have this new technology. It's called bricks. So instead of going and gathering your stones of all shapes and sizes and hardness, you have these mass-produced bricks, and you can stack them like blocks, and you can build cities. It's just amazing what you can do with these things. And they have this tar for their mortar, which was also used on the ark, so they know about this tar. So now they're mass producing this new technology. So they're using brick for stone and tar for mortar. New technology, things are going well. So, verse 4, what do they build? Go to, let us build hospitals and food pantries and homes for the elderly and houses and orchards. Is that what they build? Of course not. Nope. Let us build a tower whose top may reach to heaven. Let us make a name. Yeah, we did just read about this region, this man with a name. Let's make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth, which is precisely what God told them to do, right? No, we don't want to do that. No. Let's congregate together. Let's make a name for ourselves. Okay, so what is this tower? This tower is, from what I understand, is what they call a ziggurat. A ziggurat is part of a temple complex. Okay? It's not just an innocent skyscraper. This is part of a temple complex. Maybe something like this. A humongous temple complex. This ziggurat is basically a man-made high place. Remember from Genesis chapter 2, we have the high places, the intersection between heaven and earth, a habitat for the gods is basically what they are building. Let me get caught up in my notes here. So, they ignored the command that God gave humanity, gave to Noah and his sons to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Instead, they congregate together and use this new technology to bring the divine down to earth, to cohabit with the gods. This is an inversion of Genesis 6, is it not? Where the gods, the sons of God, come to earth. Now we have man wanting to go up to the gods and cohabit with the gods. It's the complete inversion of that. And I'll talk more about this in a little bit, but this is a disaster in the making. It's precisely what God did not want to happen. God told them to scatter. And I don't know what it is about humanity and about the sons of God, two different realms, always wanting to go to each other's realm. But even I think that's even relevant today. God placed us on this earth, and we should be content with what he has chosen to do, and we should serve him to the best of our abilities and not have this, this extreme fascination with the other realm, maybe is one thing we could say. Okay, so God invests. Verse 5, so they build this tower. I don't know if this is intentional or not, but you kind of get the idea that man went way up there to build this tower, and this was a magnificent structure. And what does it say that God does in verse 5? Oh, God came down. There's something down there. Barely see it. So let's go down and see what took place. So God investigates. And God came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. So God has to come down to investigate this thing. And again, I love this. God does this seemingly every time, whether it's Adam and Eve sinning in the garden, whether it's he always investigates. He comes down and asks questions and investigates the situation. So God investigates it, and he says, behold, the people is one. They're unified. They have one language. And this they began to do. Now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do, or purposed to do. I love the way the King James says, imagine to do. What do we know about man's imagination? Remember? It's only evil continually. Yes, God said, we can't send another flood. We can't send more water because that doesn't cure a man's heart. The imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. So floods do not cure man's heart. But we are going to get a flood-like judgment. God's going to send judgment upon these people and scatter them. Let us go down, verse 7, and confound their language. That word confound is Babel. Babel their language. The word Babel is a transliterated word. For some reason, the translators chose not to translate it. They transliterated it to Babel. The translated word is Babylon. And for some reason, here they wanted to keep, I think, the wordplay that God babbled their language. So the Lord scattered them from abroad, verse 8, of all the earth, and they left off from building the city. Verse 9, therefore the name is called Babel. because the Lord did babble their language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad from upon the face of the whole earth. So you get the idea here that this is when God divided humanity, divided and disinherited them. If you don't want me to be your God, if you don't want me, you don't want to obey me, you don't have to. So and then following this, from chapter 10, we get a genealogy. We'll cover this one of the next messages. We get this genealogy that leads us to Abraham. There's 10 generations of genealogy starting in verse 10. And then we get to Abraham in verse 27. And then the scriptures hone in on Abraham. No more collectively are we talking about the whole world of all of humanity. Now God zeroes in, calls out Abraham, and blesses him. And if you look in just chapter 12, verse 6, you already have the Canaanite nations there. Verse 10, you have Egypt. If you turn the page over to chapter 14, you have all these different kings, 4 against 5, fighting against each other. They don't want to pay taxes to each other. So you already have the nations fighting against each other. So clearly, there were no nations up to this point. Humanity was one. Now they are divided. Okay, so why am I bringing so much emphasis? Well, this is what is called the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. Deuteronomy 32 worldview. What's the Deuteronomy 32 worldview? It is Deuteronomy. We'll start in verse 7. Remember the days of old. So we're being asked to think back to the days of old. Remember, this was Moses with the children of Israel. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, he will show you. Your elders, they will tell you. When the Most High, so who's the Most High? Yahweh is the Most High, right? He is the Most High. He's the uncreated. All others were created. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the people according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is his allotted inheritance. So when humanity here in chapter 11 disobeyed God, they wanted to make another habitation with the other gods, God said, okay, I'm going to separate you. I'm going to scatter you, even though you don't want to be scattered. You're going to be scattered. And you are going to have the lesser gods, the created gods, the ones that God shares his rule with. They're going to be your God. These corrupt gods are going to be your God. And so he divided the nations according to the number of the sons of God. These lesser Elohims, these lesser gods, the ones that you have appearances like in Job where the sons of God come together and they have a council there and Satan comes in among them. Those are the ones that God divvied out these nations to. If you tell God no long enough and hard enough, he will allow you free choice. Okay, a similar verse is in Deuteronomy 4:19. Beware lest you raise your eyes to the heavens when you see the sun, moon, and stars, and all the host of heaven, and you be drawn away and bow down and serve them. Things that the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven. So the way they thought of these sons of God were that they were the stars in the sky, they were in the heavens, they were the lights in the heavens, and so they would bow down and worship them. That's how they thought of these other gods. But Yahweh, verse 20, but the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be a people of his own inheritance, as you are this day. So another very similar verse. You clearly see that God gave over humanity to these sons of God, and God chose Abraham, through which Israel comes, for his inheritance. And you know the story. Israel was to be this mediator between God and the nations, to bring the nations back. We're going to read that in our next. The very purpose of calling out Abraham was that through Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So whenever humanity rejects God and God gives them what they want, he immediately begins with a plan to bring them back, to bless them again. It's going to be a long, drawn-out plan, but he immediately sets order and plan. It reminds me of Genesis 3:15, where right after they partook of the fruit, the forbidden fruit, God says someday there will be a snake crusher who will crush the head of the serpent. Immediately, there's a glimmer of hope. Okay, so back to Deuteronomy 8:32. So inevitably, someone is going to be reading their Bible in the next week and thinking about what I said today, and they're going to read Deuteronomy 32:8, and I'm saying that the ESV here says, according to the number of God, the number of the sons of God, and you're going to pull out your King James, and it's going to say, according to the number of the children of Israel. And you're going to say, uh-oh, Dwight, here he goes, picking versions, he's making, twisting things, making say what he wants. All right, so why the textual difference? There is an absolute, it's not a translation, it's a manuscript variance. So it's not just the translation variance, it's a manuscript variant. So why not go with the children of Israel? Well, when God divided the nations, there was no children of Israel. Did you notice that in Genesis 10, there was no children of Israel in those lists? So how could you divide according to the number of the children of Israel if there was none? All right, so there's the first caveat. Furthermore, I'm not sure how dividing according to the number would even make sense. Like, what good does that do? They're not ruling over anyone. So I don't know. I don't really get that. That's one argument against that translation. There was no children of Israel. The second argument is that the Septuagint. What is the Septuagint? The Septuagint is the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, in their Hebrew, translated into Greek over the time of Jesus. It had been done by the time Jesus came. But the apostles used the Greek Septuagint as their main Old Testament. According to what I understand, this would have been their most familiar version of the Old Testament, was the Septuagint. And it says, the sons of God. So there's another reason you might consider this. The third reason is the Dead Sea Scrolls say the same thing. The Dead Sea Scrolls were just discovered in the last about 50 years, and they were in a cave in the Dead Sea region, and they say the sons of God as well. So to me, it makes a lot more sense. It would explain why these nations were so involved in idolatry. These corrupt sons of God wanted the worship to themselves. They did not pass it on to God. They wanted the honor, the glory, the worship to themselves. And they led these nations into all kinds of horrific things, idolatry, sacrificing their children, all kinds of evil things. And I don't know how else you could get inspired to do that outside of just some divine, evil, corrupt being giving you these commands, these directions. So, for whatever it's worth, I wouldn't die on this hill necessarily, but I think it's fairly logical. Now, inevitably, someone's going to also say, but Dwight, don't you know that God owns the whole world? I mean, you know, I remember in school, being grown up, I was told that this temptation that the devil gave Jesus about the kingdoms of this world and the glory of them, will I give them to him? I was told, well, it's really a trick question because they were gods to begin with. Can't give him what he already has. And there's really no temptation here. You know, it's just kind of a trick question. No, there was actually a temptation here. There was two ways that Jesus could regain his position of authority, and that was this way, or by dying to the cross, by following the will of the Father. This was the shortcut. This would have been the shortcut, but no, he chose to follow the plan of the Father and to die on behalf of us all. So you have free will, right? You do have free will. You can choose to serve other gods. You have that free will. If we would just say that, no, they didn't have this. No, there's only God. There's no other. Well, then you really don't have free will. But we do have free will. We can reject God if you want to. You can reject. You can make that choice. But you cannot choose the consequences. And I think that's where so much of what we read goes wrong, is they do what seems good in their own eyes. Adam and Eve do what seems good in their own eyes. They take of the fruit, but you cannot choose the consequences. The consequences are laid in stone. For example, this is Deuteronomy 8:19, and it shall be, if thou do at all forget the Lord thy God and walk after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that ye shall surely perish. There's the consequence. So you have a choice to make, but you can't choose the consequence. Well, humanity made a choice here, and that was to reject God, and it brought real consequences. Real, painful, horrible consequences. And so, to a very large degree, these lesser gods, these sons of God, created Elohim that God intended for them to partner with him, to rule on his behalf in the heavenly realm, were given to them to be their gods, and they were corrupt. So this brings us to another interesting thing that I've discovered through studying and through different sources, and this is how the Israelites thought of their land, their real estate, we would say, their geography. We'll call it cosmic geography. It's kind of a fancy word there, but we'll just use it for the anyhow. So their real estate. So since there were these gods divvied out to these other nations, Israel was Yahweh's inheritance. The land of Israel was holy. It was God's real estate. If you walked over to Egypt, you were on another God's territory. And you didn't want to do that. You wanted to stay in God's real estate, on God's territory. So Daniel, when he goes and prays, he's not on God's territory anymore. He was taken captive over to Babylon. He would pray. Let me just read it. And Daniel knew that the writing was signed. He went into his house, his window being open, and his chamber toward Jerusalem. He knelt upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks to God as he did aforetime. Daniel knew that over there, that direction, was Jerusalem. That was God's real estate. And he bowed and prayed towards that area of land, that holy ground area. I don't know how many of you remember this really strange detail when Naaman came over to the prophet Prophet Samuel, and he went and dipped 7 times in the river, came back up, he went, and he tried, sorry, it was Prophet Elijah, I had a mind blank, Prophet Elijah, there we go, and he wanted to give Elijah something in return. Elijah said, no, won't take anything, and then Naaman said, okay, if not, then let there be given 2 mule loads of earth. 2 mule loads of dirt, soil. For from now on, your servant will not offer burnt offerings or sacrifice to any but Yahweh, the Lord. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant when thy master goeth into the house of Ramon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I will bow myself in the house of Ramon. When I bow myself in the house of Ramon, the Lord may pardon your servant in this matter. And Elijah says to him, go in peace. So Naaman is, he's got a master, and he's got a job to do when he gets home. And part of that job is to go with his master into this house. I understand he was an older man. And they would go into this to offer sacrifices to these gods. And Naaman's like, I want to take this holy ground because I believe that your God, Yahweh, is the true God. And I'm going to go back to Syria. And I know that the Syrians, that their God is not the true God. I want to take this holy ground with me. I want to take a piece of Yahweh back with me. And Elijah, if I still have to go into this, to this temple, and I still have to help with the sacrifices, will God pardon me? Because I know this is not the true God. Elijah just says, go in peace. I don't know. Fascinating. We have the battle for territory here in Daniel. You remember that when God sent a messenger to reveal the vision to Daniel. Daniel was praying for 3 weeks, and then on the 23rd day, finally, this messenger shows up to speak with Daniel and said that the prince of Persia held him up for 3 weeks. He goes on to tell Daniel, but now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come, but I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends by my side except against these except Michael, your prince. So there you have another, this idea of there's areas where these gods are in control. And even for this messenger from God, from Yahweh, to go into this land, he had to have help from the archangel Michael to get in. So I think there's something to this. I personally do. All right. The judgment of these sons of God. So obviously they were horrible. They led the people into all kinds of idolatry, all kinds of wickedness. And in Psalms 82, this is the complete Psalms, God is very ticked at these guys, and he is going to pronounce judgment on them. Let's read Psalms 82. This is in the ESV. God has taken his place in the divine council. I think the King James will say, in the congregation, maybe, of the gods. I think it says in the congregation of the gods, maybe. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. So think back to the Job scene, where they're together, and they're having a cabinet meeting, you might say. How long, this is God speaking, how long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak. Sorry, let me pop that up there. Okay. Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. They have neither knowledge or understanding. They walk in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I'm all the way down to verse 6 now. I said, you are God's sons of the Most High. All of you, nevertheless, like men you shall die and fall like any prince. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all nations. So clearly, these lesser gods are corrupt. They are destroying humanity. They're leading them into idolatry. And God pronounces a judgment upon them and tells them they will die like men. And then the psalmist says, arise, O God, you shall inherit all nations. So, Why do I bring this out? Why would I go into all these different examples? I think it does us well to understand just what condition the world was in before Jesus came. Just how tragic these circumstances were. Just how hopeless these situations were. And I know you have times where Jonah goes to Nineveh. Okay, that would be in the realm. There are times where seems like they had free access into another country without any hindrances. I don't understand everything, but I do believe that these sons of God are very corrupt and had a lot to do with the downfall of these nations. You think about how much influence they had in the case of Job, where Satan somehow inspired lots of destruction there in the story of Job. So to some extent, they very much do affect. Obviously, Psalms there says that they were oppressing the widows and what are all other accusations that were there. So in closing, I want to go back to one of the last verses I did, and hopefully this one will make 100% sense now. I remember when I first read Ephesians 3:8, I just didn't have a clue what this meant. I thought it was the most weirdest, strangest verse ever. So Paul is saying here, although I am the least of all the saints, this grace was given to me to bring to the Gentiles, to the nations. Okay, Jesus opened the way to all the nations to be brought into the family of God. So this good news, this gospel was given to me to bring to the Gentiles the news of the boundless riches of Christ and to make everyone see what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things, so that through the church, the wisdom of God in its rich variety might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. So the church, which is not divided by nations, it's whosoever will. We don't shun you out because you're not of a certain culture or a certain tribe. The church is God's answer to these divisions. And these rulers and authorities in heavenly places, these sons of God, when they see this, they marvel. They didn't know this was possible. And they see the manifold wisdom of God. Through the church, the wisdom of God in its rich variety might be made known to the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. So, I think next time I preach, we're going to go a little bit more into the New Testament. I decided to stay mostly in the Old Testament this time. I think we're going to just go back into the New Testament and focus maybe a little bit more on the kingdom of God. And as you think of all these divided nations throughout the whole earth and their gods, and now Jesus comes in and introduces a new kingdom, new rulership. He reestablishes what a ruler looks like. You're not going to lord it over them, but you're going to be the servant. You're going to come out and you're going to be the lowest. I think we're going to go that direction next time. But I want to close with Matthew 28. So Jesus isn't just lost for words and he's like, oh yeah, I just should just remind them that I am God after all and I'm all powerful. Something has actually changed from the temptation that Satan presented Jesus to now the resurrected Jesus is in authority and power. And Jesus came and said unto them, all authority in heaven and earth has been given me. So you no longer need to fear to go to Babylon because I have all authority and all power. And if you go in my name, they cannot touch you. So all authority has been given me in heaven and earth. Go therefore and make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things I have commanded you, and behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. Our world is drastically different today than what it was after Babel. And you begin to think of the consequences of Genesis 3, Genesis 6, and Genesis 11. There's, I think, I don't know, Are these sons of God, these corrupt sons of God, are they still around? I think you can choose to still worship them. I think you can. I think Jesus offers us another way. He offers his light. He offers victory over spiritual evil and spiritual wickedness. Paul says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against spiritual wicked in high places and heavenly places. I think you still have the option, but Jesus is all powerful, and under his authority, we can go without fear, and we can be victors. We do not have to fear enslavement by these corrupt gods. And just to contrast these gods, demanding sacrifices of children, demanding all this idolatrous stuff, Jesus says, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. The one true good king, the one true good ruler is Jesus. And we live underneath his rulership today. He is Lord of heaven and earth. All authority is his. Not all opposition has been put under his feet yet. So we have a choice. That's all I have for you. Let's kneel for prayer.